Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys at a kitchen table talking about Bitcoin and the broader Bitcoin space. Though we may own some of the equities and tokens discussed on the show, it doesn't mean that you should own them too. It's important to do your own research and due diligence, and also understand that any money invested could be lost. Nothing we say is financial advice, and honestly, you shouldn't ever take financial advice from two guys at a kitchen table, regardless of whether or not there's microphones in front of them. Welcome, friends and enemies, to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. My name is Joey. I'm here with my co-host, Len, as always, and joining us this evening, Mario Gibney. Am I saying that right? I hope I am.
You nailed it.
Perfect. From the Unhashed podcast, man of many talents, man of many jobs, and hopefully tonight too, man with some background on the Taproot upgrade coming to Bitcoin. My friend, how are you doing?
Doing great. Thanks for having me on.
Pleasure's all ours. So we got a few questions for you. Len, I'll let you take it away, and let's get this rip going.
So Mario, you're on the island, Vancouver Island, so in Victoria. So tell us what's going on the island these days during COVID.
I don't know, man. My life was already pretty much online before this all hit. So I've been pretty lucky in that I haven't been affected too much by it than compared to a lot of places. Like, it's not Toronto, basically, on what I've been hearing out of there. So we've been kind of lucky in the island, sheltered from the worst of it. I can't eat in restaurants now, which sucks, but just eating the patio. I did spend a few months out in Alberta. I grew up in Alberta, and I ended up going to crash with an old middle school friend of mine, because I was like between places when COVID hit, and then I was going to go traveling, and that got canceled, of course, and so he invited me to go stay with him. So kind of got to go do the prairie thing for a bit, but I was just like living in a suburb. So I'm back here. I'm just like checking the vaccination rates every day, hoping that by the summer things start to open up again. That's kind of it on this end. You guys are around, you guys are in GTA, right?
Correct. Yeah. Hamilton for me and Oakville for Len. So we're like, the absolute most lockdown place in the entire country, that maybe in the entire world at this point. I'm not sure what Europe looks like, but it can't be much worse than this. If I go outside, people look at me funny. So not pretty.
Where are they
not
looking pretty. At you from? Their windows? Are they like binoculars?
They're surveillance cameras.
Buddy. Yeah. I don't know if you follow the news around here,
but like,
no, dude, like they have people, there was like pictures of garbage bags over basketball nets, and like they had, you know, caution tape around play structures and parks and all that. Like Ford, I mean,
they
I don't want to get
my
political,
tennis court.
That's nuts. Cause like, I mean, here, like I saw a lot of people complaining that like, you know, you pointed out like, why don't you encourage people to get outside and exercise? Cause if you're healthy, you're fighting a virus. And to be honest, like they've been pretty good about it here. Like if you look around, like there are like signs everywhere in the parks, but like stay active, but like stay distant. So like, I mean, I think they're. We've been lucky here, but I'll be coming to join you. I moved to Toronto in the summer, though, so that's one of the reasons I'm hoping stuff clears up by then. Purely selfish reasons, yeah.
When are we having the Canadian Bitcoiners piss up at some GTA pub sometime in August? Probably.
Yeah, no, we'll do that. I love doing the meetup thing. That's how I got involved in the space. So I'll be meeting some people in MeetSpace once that's a thing again.
Give me a little bit of background on your story. You kind of started to touch on it there. How'd you get involved in all this this internet money business?
Yeah, I have a completely irrelevant background. Like I studied like, you know, liberal arts university, and then I went and spent most of my 20s teaching English and like studying in South Korea. And I think it was back in 2015 when I first heard of Bitcoin. Some dude at a bar was raving about it. And then I like forgot about it for about a year. And then I had some spare time. I was in between I just like quit the school program I was in. I hadn't started my next job yet. And I kind of remember this kind of Bitcoin thing that popped into my head and poked around a bit. And I found this English speaking meetup group, like a 15 minute walk from where I was, which like in a city the size of Seoul is like, it's crazy. It's like next door. And I rolled up and I became really fast friends with the guys there. It was run by Ruben Thompson, who's since become a very close friend of mine. He's a Dutch guy who'd been living in Korea for a while and ran this meetup. And he's just like, he just like taught me shit ton over the next year and a half. I got sucked down the rabbit hole right away, kind of, you know, binge watched a bunch of Andreas Antonopoulos videos, started taking online courses in coding, cryptography, and just like once a week we'd show up to the coffee shop and just figure out what was going on and ask each other questions. And and then 2017 hit. You had, you know, Cryptomania back then. It took off, like especially in Korea. And so, you know, suddenly our meetup group, which was like, you know, usually like half a dozen guys meeting in a coffee shop once a week, we had like, you know, 40 50 60 people coming out. So we started actually doing like proper like monthly like presentations to people and stuff. And at that point, I was one of the organizers. If you want to learn something, commit yourself to teaching it. That'll do it. And And yeah, back in 2017, we got kind of involved with the whole, you know, block size civil war at the time. And thanks to, well, we got a bit of attention over that because we spoke out as the meetup. And through then, I ended up meeting Warren Togami, who's the VP of Solutions at Blockstream. And he suggested I apply for a job with Blockstream. And that was early 2018. And yeah, moved back to Victoria for that. And I worked there as the customer support lead for just over 3 years until about earlier this month, I joined the Ledin.io team as a director of community.
I just want to double back to your experience in Korea. So like the kimchi premium, I want to talk to you about that and get your opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah. So like just for people that are not aware, the kimchi premium is the gap in the cryptocurrency prices between South Korean exchanges compared to the exchanges located globally. So if you could just talk on that, I'm curious to see what your thoughts are.
Sure. So yeah, you had this situation that happened repeatedly during 2017 that, you know, the price of Bitcoin would be like, you know, 5-10% higher in Korea, and then it would go away. And then it eventually got up to a max of like 50% in a 50% premium for at least one day in early 2018. So what happened there is that if you have this combination of strong demand for Bitcoin or cryptocurrencies, plus capital controls, that's what causes the price to get out of whack. Because like normally, if let's say you compare like United States to Canada, and if suddenly there's a surge of Bitcoin demand in Canada and the price is like, you know, 10% or higher here, then what people are going to do is they're going to, you know, send money to the United States, buy Bitcoin there, send the Bitcoin back to Canada, sell it at profit. And you could just repeat this cycle. And it's like, you know, it's just money. You could make whatever the ARB difference, you know, minus your slippage and fees, whatever, in like however long it takes to send the money. In Korea, you can't send more than $50,000 out of the country a year without like special permission. And so, you know, at the time, like I was an English teacher, I was making like 25 grand a year probably total. So they weren't going to extend that for me. I think if you're like a foreign worker there, you're making more than that, they'll make an extension. But like, it's just very difficult to get money out of the country. So like when this happened, like a few of us were like, oh, sweet, we can do this. And I would like send 10 grand home and like buy Bitcoin on like Quadriga and then send it back to Korea and then like sell it there. But like you do this like a couple times and you've used your like yearly limit for remittances. And so, yeah, basically, I mean, you have capital controls basically stopping arbitrage from happening. And then what ends up happening is everybody scrambling for ways to get around these regulations and sneak money out of the country. And there was all sorts of crazy shit going on all the time. It was an interesting time.
Tell me about this. So the kimchi premium, this is something that went on there for how long, would you say? You said 2017, 2018. Is it still going on now? What's the deal with this sort of thing?
Well, so like I remember learning about it first or like realizing it was there. It was probably mid to early 2017, where it was just like we're kind of realizing that there was like a 5-10% difference. And then what happens is a bunch of people realize there's profit to be made here. They find ways to get out of the country. And then the more people do that, that causes the price to rebalance. And then so it would like, you know, go up to like, you know, 10% and then like come down after a few weeks. Then we'll go up 10, maybe up to 15 and come down. And then I remember we were like jumping on it like, yeah, late 2017, but they just like kept on going up. And then you also had this situation where that was like that was the peak of the last of the last cycle. And so when the price is like crashing in the rest of the world and price demand is still kind of high in Korea, then that's when you saw the really extreme differences popping up. But like over time, there's always gonna be pressure for that to trend to zero. Because anyone who can figure out a way to get money out of the country, you know, either by, you know, legal or other means, will just have like will be able to basically like print money for themselves until it goes away. So there's always going to be pressure to trend it towards zero. It's just with capital controls, it makes it difficult to do. And so that means, you know, more profit for people who can figure out how to do it.
And going back to your time at Blockstream, did you ever meet Adam Back? And if so, what are your thoughts on him?
Oh yeah, I'm a huge fan of Adam Back. Like, I mean, I was a big Blockstream fanboy before I joined, so it was like really a dream come true for them to hire me. And yeah, I did get to meet Adam a couple of times. Super approachable guy. He was really sharp. He is as he seems in his interviews and stuff. He doesn't like put on a persona for anything. So yeah,
He's like an old time cypherpunk, right? Like, so these guys, him, Sabo, a few of the other OGs from the original sort of Bitcoin talk forums. How much you think that went into the like Blockstream ethos? Because I know now, obviously, they're, I don't know, industry leader is probably it's probably almost too gentle a term, like as far as the stuff they're putting out with Splashing Satellite, and they have like a mobile wallet now and all this stuff. So they're on both sort of ends of the spectrum as far as accessibility. What do you think the, what do you think the contribution of that original Cypherpunk dream was or is to that company's sort of vision as it stands today? And any thoughts
heavily,
on that?
It's heavily embedded in the culture. Yeah. And like, you know, Adam was one of, I think it was about 9 co-founders. Like it was quite a significant team that co-founded Blockstream. Like, originally it was most of the authors of this, of the original paper about sidechains. And I think there was like 8 authors on the paper, and I think about 6 of them went on to be co-founders, in Blockstream. And so Adam was like one of many, you know, like, you know, you also had, you know, people like, you know, Andrew Polstra and Peter Weller and like Mark Friedenbach and like, you know, Matt Corral, like lots of these names. And they, like, even though, you know, Adam is a bit older than most of them. And so like, he's been around like, you know, since the 90s, and but they also, like, a lot of these guys were, you know, cryptographers and were, you know, very much a part of the whole cypherpunk scene and kind of jumped on Bitcoin like quite early in the days. And so that, yeah, it's very much embedded into the culture there. And you can see it with the tools they build and, like, you know, where the research is oriented. It's a big influence.
And let's go a little more current to your current position at Ledin. Just expand more what you're doing today and maybe give a shameless plug on your business.
Yeah, absolutely. I would love to. Thanks for asking. So I'll go back a bit. I am currently living on the West Coast, but I was bouncing pre-COVID. I was bouncing between here and Toronto quite a bit. I have a lot of family friends out there. And while I was there, I went to one of these Bitcoin steak dinners. And that's where I first met Adam and Maurizio. Adam Reeds and Maurizio Di Bartolomeo. They're the two co-founders of Ledin. And I met them at this this dinner, and we, you know, ended up chatting. And I had already been using BlockFi a bit, which I'll like for their you know, interest accounts. And so when I met them, Ledin is you know, also a player in the you know, Bitcoin backed loans and interest accounts. And so I kind of was familiar with the business model already, and you know, really hit it off with them. Really great guys. Like, I've considered them friends for a couple of years now, and became an early client, and kind of been a one of those clients, you know, keep on bugging, hey, you guys should add this, you should fix this. And so we kept in pretty close contact, and so it was about a year and a half I'd known them. And then a couple months ago, they just reached out and were kind of saying, yeah, why don't you have you considered joining the team? And so we had a few calls, and I think it's a really great fit. Right now I'm director of community, so I'm going to be helping Maurizio with a lot of marketing stuff, and then also a bit more of the I'm able to help the team with more of the Bitcoin specific content, because, you know, I was fortunate enough to learn from a lot of the really, really technically expert people at Blockstream, and so I'm able to bring a bit of that value to the company. So hoping to kind of, like, I mean, because my general impression of Ledin, like using it as a client for a few years, I was really impressed with the service. I'm biased saying this now, but I think they are head and shoulders above their competitors in terms of transparency, in terms of kind of responsibility running their you know, being a custodian, because, like, we've seen how that can go wrong in the past. So that's, like, not a small undertaking, and I really trust Maurizio and Adam a lot, and so I just want to help get the word out there, and that's what I'm doing now.
What would you say to people like me who have a significant Bitcoin position but don't use the interest in lending accounts because of I don't know, I would call it FUD, but that's probably the wrong term, Mario. I think maybe just because of the sort of not your keys, not your coin ethos of the community and the self-sovereign, you know, the self-sovereign nature of the Bitcoin mission. We'll just say to someone like me, because we get a lot of questions, I'll be honest with you, between the YouTube stuff we've done on other channels, between friends of mine asking about the interest in lending, between, you know, all the different avenues where people can reach out to us and talk to us about stuff that they can do with their Bitcoin in the fiat world. This is a concern that I have. So I'm curious to hear your thoughts on that.
Okay. Yeah. First, let me just, like, quickly describe the products we have. So there are two different savings accounts we have, one for Bitcoin, one for USDC. It's your, you know, basic savings account. You deposit your coins with us, and then we lend them out to institutions that pay interest on them, and we pass on most of that interest to you. And right, so that's the one product. The other thing we do are the Bitcoin-backed loans, where if you want quick access to, you know, dollar value, and you want to use your Bitcoin as collateral, you can post them up, and we will issue you a loan in U.S. dollars. And so we can either wire it to you or send it to you with USDC. And then we have a B2X type of loan, which is a specific type of loan for clients who want to use the loan money to buy more Bitcoin. We kind of automate that for you in the background. So you can put up one Bitcoin, we'll issue you a loan at the value of that Bitcoin, immediately buy more Bitcoin for you in the background. And then both of the Bitcoins are up as your collateral. And then price goes up, you can sell, and then you'll get back more than one Bitcoin. You go in, of course, the price can go down as well. So you got to be careful and watch your margin. So those are the products we're talking about here, just in case anyone, just so no one's left behind. Right. So this, it's really interesting to come to this space because it's a very, very different type of work than we were doing at Blockstream, which was totally, you know, don't trust, verify, not your keys, not your coins. We build tools to help you directly manage your own Bitcoin. Whereas this is the opposite of that. This, you are putting trust in us to manage your funds for you. Now, I don't spend any time trying. If someone's really happy with their self-storage, like keeping the stuff in the hardware wallet, I'm not going to spend any time trying to convince them not to do that. That's awesome. Go for it. I did that for most of the time I've been in Bitcoin. That's what I've done. Partly because there just have been a lot of like Mickey Mouse ops run in the last, 10 years. I don't need to. I presume the listeners of the show know about what happened with Mt. Gox, with Quadriga. Like look at what's happening in Turkey right now. I think you guys talked about that in your last episode. Like you have a lot of these things happen. And so there's, the people who have kept their coins over the years are the people who have learned to store themselves safely. So I totally get it. Like that being said, like there's a risk reward trade-off here. And for some people, I think it might be worth it. Partly if you're a person who, let's say, isn't like technically inclined. Like, I mean, most of the friends that I introduce to Bitcoin, I help them set up with their own wallets. There are some friends who just like, they're not that interested in learning how to do this themselves. If they're just going to leave their money on Coinbase, I would definitely encourage them to, leave it somewhere they're earning the interest as well. I think when you're looking into this as well, do your due diligence, like do research. Like we make a huge effort to be as transparent as we can. If you reach out to our team, we will respond. We'll have calls with you. Our money is lent out through Genesis. Genesis does quarterly reports. Both companies, us and our lending partner Genesis, are like backed by like established VC firms. So it's not like these aren't, these fly by night operations that kind of, send us your Bitcoin, we'll send it to you back. Like the industry has matured a lot and it's going to continue to mature. I totally get it. Like I'm not going to sit here and like try and convince you to put down your coins because you are a person who's competent in Bitcoin. You know what you're doing. And, if you're comfortable with that safety profile, stick with what you're doing. That's totally cool. I mean, who knows? Maybe someday you find a need to, get quick access to some dollars and then you want to post to the Bitcoin somewhere. That's when you can come to us. But that's where I'm at right now.
What would you say to the people who, I shouldn't compare you guys directly to BlockFi, but they're probably your closest comp. And so there's people who have had a bad experience with BlockFi over the years. I know they just lowered their rates, for example, given the recent price moves. And I think there's a story recently. I don't think it was them. I think it was Celsius who told their clients they'd have to deposit more Bitcoin, basically ASAP, to avoid getting margined. And so what do you guys do in situations like that? You mentioned that you're transparent. Are you transparent enough in terms of situations like that to protect your customers? I mean, you sort of said there already that probably some of the clients you get, maybe not all, but some percentage are technically not incompetent, but maybe less technically inclined as far as cold storage. And so maybe they would be not panicked, but certainly taken aback or shooken up a bit by that kind of email. So how do you guys balance that? Your clients are more or less going to be a bit more uncomfortable with self-sovereignty with this other risk stuff that goes on in the background at Ledin and presumably BlockFi and these other lending services as well.
Right. Okay. So there are kind of two separate questions there. One was about the change of rates over time and one was about margin calls on the loan. So let's stick with the rates question first. Like the rates are going to fluctuate month to month. This is still an early industry. It's maturing. Bitcoin doesn't get to a point where it's global money and there's no demand to borrow it. It's just a question of what are those rates going to be? They are going to fluctuate over time. And we've endeavored to make it clear from the beginning that the rates we have now are not guaranteed to last forever. We will pass on the highest savings rate we can that is sustainable for our clients. But they do change. We announce at the end of each month what the next month's interest rate is going to be. I don't know if we've announced ours yet, but if not, the email will be going out next day or two. But it's not changing for May. We're able to keep the interest rates where they are. The interest rates are going to change over time. That's like, you can expect that. A lot of people have made like a really big deal out of interest rates changing in different companies as like, kind of a sign that the business model was shaking. But no, this is expected. It's going to happen over time. As for like the other thing you were asking about is a situation where someone puts up their Bitcoin, they get a loan, and then Bitcoin price crashes a bunch and they get told to put more collateral in. Well, yeah, this is to be expected, right? The reason we're able to provide these loans is because we Bitcoin is really effective collateral, and you know, it's easy to liquidate. We can quickly sell it for dollars back if something like this happens. But we do make it very, very clear, and we try and do our best to help our customers keep an eye on how their collateral is doing. Like, it's not in our interest to have people liquidate. We don't want that. We want our clients to be able to get their money in and out when they want to. So what we do, this is why we require two times collateral. So if you want to take out $10,000, you got to put up $20,000 worth of Bitcoin. Now, if the price of Bitcoin drops a bunch, we send out, there are several thresholds that get met, and then we will send out, email to our clients being like, right now you're at 70% loan to value. We'd suggest you put a bit more collateral in to make sure you stay afloat, or, close the loan or whatever you need to do. And I think there would be another one at 75% loan to value. And then at 80%, that's when we need to, that is when we would need to use a collateral to buy back the money we've lent. And then there would still be some left over, and it would be credited back to the client. But again, like we make a lot of effort to communicate really clearly to our clients, what those levels are, and help them, top up to make sure that that doesn't happen. But sometimes it does. Last year we had this crazy event in March where the price of Bitcoin crashed quite a bit, and I wasn't around at the time. But our business model stayed strong. But we didn't. We didn't have any event where funds were lost or were unable to liquidate in time. But unfortunately, some clients were liquidated, didn't get secure in time. So if you are going to do this, I would stress be careful with it. Keep a really close eye. The price. Over collateralizing is a good thing to do. It's a lot safer than trying to run the minimum. And yeah, we try to be really open about that.
So I've done a little bit of digging in your company, and you guys get really good reviews, and this is great because you're in a customer service environment. So anybody looking for your type of services, definitely look at Ledin. It's a great place to actually get what you're looking for. But in terms of the breakdown, you could earn interest, you could borrow, and you got the B2X. Which of the three is the most popular, and why?
So the most popular is probably the I don't actually have the numbers off the top of my head, but probably the interest accounts. Because that's also the easiest to use. It's easiest to understand, right? Because your Bitcoin, and then each month you get paid extra Bitcoin on top of that, and you can withdraw when you need to. That's what I started with. In terms of profitability, the loans are very profitable for us. So that's kind of where the money's made. And what we'll do is we'll see a lot more activity. Like when the price dips a bunch, people will keep Bitcoin in their savings account. And like, let's say a dip hits, the price goes down by 20%. Instead of people scrambling to get fiat onto an exchange or something like that, they could just use the B2X product, wait for the price to go up again, close it, and then they've earned themselves some extra Bitcoin.
So I want to just transition over to Taproot, and I think that's going to be the base of our discussion going forward. What is Taproot, and why is it important to the normie BTC user?
Yeah, great. So Taproot is an update to the Bitcoin protocol, which fingers crossed, I think has a decent chance of getting activated sometime this year. It looks like, we can get into activation maybe later. But Taproot itself it's an update to the scripting capability of Bitcoin, which it essentially enhances scalability and privacy. So right now there are all sorts of the word smart contracts kind of become tainted at this point, but if you're sending money to a Bitcoin address that is more complicated than a single signature, that's multi-sig or has some time locks in it. So this would be used for cold storage often uses multi-sig for heavier security, or if you want to open or close Lightning channels, that often involves scripts that require, multi-sig or time locks and these things. So what happens when you're spending from that, you have all this extra data that goes into the transaction. So you have two signatures instead of one, and signatures are a big part of the data space required in transactions that you're paying fees for. And what Taproot allows you to do is it allows you to break up, if there are multiple spending conditions for a script, if you're sending some address that says, you can spend this using these two keys or using this key in a time lock, it actually separates those two scripts in a Merkle tree. So you commit the hash of this data, and then when you're spending, you only reveal the path that you end up using. And so then the path that doesn't get used never hits the blockchain. So that data doesn't need to be written to it. And that's, it saves you space. It allows for more of these large transactions to happen on the network, and enhances privacy. And actually, it does more than that, because there's a cryptographic trick that they use where they... you have the script broken up into a Merkle tree, and there's different branches. And then the Merkle root, which is the hash of kind of all the data where it comes together, can also be, you can produce a signature that basically spins from that. And what that is, I'm kind of jumping around a bit too much here. There's also, okay, so I described kind of the way you can make your script into a tree and hide branches. The other half of it is has to do with Schnorr signatures and signature aggregation. So this is actually Taproot plus Schnorr signatures, which if you have a multi-sig you're spanning from that requires several signatures, you can combine those signatures into a single signature. And then what you can do is you can spend the signature from the Merkle root of this kind of computing scripting tree. And the end result, if I'm going to nutshell this, is that you can have people creating these more complicated and kind of data heavy spending conditions that all the parties involved can cooperate to just spend with a single signature from it. So it really, really allows for scalability of these contracts, and especially relevant to tools that kind of offer second layer solutions like Lightning or sidechains. It's going to really make it a lot easier for those things to happen on Bitcoin.
Question I have for you about the sort of Taproot, the signature merging you're describing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we call that signature aggregation is the term.
Signature aggregation. So can you compare that to what you might see in a Samurai Whirlpool, for example, or the Monero anonymity set that you get when you spend XMR? Because I'm not sure about those things, but they sound similar to me, and it sounded similar to me when I was kind of doing a little bit of background research for tonight. So if you can give a little bit of the similarities and differences, if there are any. That'd be great.
I can't compare. I can't comment specifically on Whirlpool or Monero. I believe Whirlpool is a coin join method, right? Is that right for privacy? Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's right. That's a little bit different in that coin join requires a whole bunch of different output inputs coming together, a bunch of different outputs, so you can't match which one goes to which one. And this type of signature aggregation, there are multiple types, isn't actually relevant to that because it still requires a different signature for each input, and then each output will have its own. The thing that's relevant there is a thing called cross-input aggregation, which is not being released here, but is something that is probably possible and is something in years down the road we may be able to add, where you could have a transaction with a whole bunch of different signatures for different inputs, and then you can aggregate them all together in a single signature, and then that signature could spend for each input. Now that's not relevant to Taproot right now because the improvements are limited to each input and output specifically, if that makes sense. I'm not sure. I can't comment on the Monero thing because that's not my wheelhouse, but
it's not mine either. I do have a soft spot for that coin. There's friends of mine who oftentimes when I'm evangelizing BTC, I get the same feedback from these guys about how XMR really is the privacy token you need. Instead of using a Bitcoin sidechain or a Bitcoin mix method, this is the thing you need. So I'm curious about whether Taproot can help me win those arguments, finally slap down these altcoin fools in my life. I'm hoping this will be the ticket.
I'm not sure. I mean, my view on Ethereum on Monero is that I think it's a really interesting project, but I don't think it's a good investment because it has value in that it's not like the community doesn't bullshit about what it can do. And it genuinely does offer a certain forms of privacy that Bitcoin can't. My rough understanding of it is that when you're spending coins in Monero, you don't reveal which UTXO you're spending from. That's where a lot of the privacy comes from, or all of it. I'm not 100% sure. But the problem with this is that that means that the running a node to keep track of the state of the network scales absolutely terribly compared to Bitcoin. So it's kind of doomed to stay very small and never reach scale. You could have something like a Monero sidechain. Like you could build a sidechain on Bitcoin that uses the Monero rules. And then you also wouldn't need to deal with this extra friction of interacting between different, floating currencies, because that's a pain. It might be fun for some of us to do, but that's just overhead in the world, in terms of practical usage. So I'm glad Monero exists, and I have no problems with the community, but I don't think it's ever going to be more than a small niche part of the ecosystem.
Agreed. Yeah, it's definitely.
Yeah.
Oh, sorry, I was saying it definitely seems like a niche market, that most definitely.
Yeah, I guess I didn't answer your question. I think the Taproot thing is a bit orthogonal, though, because it's a different type of privacy. It's like Taproot itself is not like a single thing that's going to make Bitcoin private for everything. It's just one of many incremental improvements, and it opens things up for you know, more privacy to move to, let's say, you know, second layer tech. But it's hard to directly to compare to things like CoinJoin and Monero. Although, like, this type of signature aggregation we're getting, I believe, is a stepping stone towards the cross-input aggregation, which would make things like a larger coin joins much more economical.
Well, so for Taproot, there seems to be some contentious issues for some time. And I was wondering what sort of problems there are and why should we go ahead with it, even though there is some opposition?
Right. Okay, so I want to clarify right now. The contention around Taproot is not whether or not we should get it. It's how we should activate it. There has been virtually no, I'm not aware, and I've looked solid critique of Taproot itself not being like good for Bitcoin. It's very, very well understood. Like, I mean, I guess there were some, I might be slightly overstating myself there, but there is very broad consensus that we want Taproot in Bitcoin. Where the contention comes from is how do we activate it? And this is a large part. It's basically PTSD from what happened back in 2017 with SegWit, where we had this method for rolling out protocol updates, where we had miners signal readiness, and this was never meant to be miners having a veto. It's just that you really want miners to be prepared for enforcing new rules on the network, because it minimizes the chances of any sort of reorgs or chaos during the rollout. I mean, it was never meant to be that the miners get to decide what goes on the network or not. And there was broad, you know, consensus that we wanted SegWit going back then. There was this, you know, conflict, and some of the miners were like, nah, we're not activating it. And then it would be really easy to get sucked down into talking about this too much. But yeah, so there was a lot of chaos ensued. And so now we have this situation where, like, okay, well, we want to have a backup plan in case the miners pull some shenanigans again. What should that be? And there was a lot of debate about what mechanism we should use to enforce that the miners kind of do their thing, or if they don't, how we can get users to just force the network to start activating these rules anyways. And there's a debate in how much control devs should have over that, whether or not they should like mark a flag day, or whether that should be something users add themselves. And then there ended up being like a lot of these arguments about nitty gritty details, which what's happening right now is there's a thing called speedy trial where they're suggesting, okay, let's roll this thing. We'll give miners the opportunity to activate it in a few months. And then if they don't, then we'll reconvene and decide what to do after that. There have been some not satisfied with that answer and believe we should have our backup plan in place already before doing this. My personal opinion is that speedy trial is going to come out and the miners are going to activate it. Things have changed a lot. I believe they have learned their lesson from 2017. They resoundly lost that fight. Look up taprootactivation.com, I think that's what it is. It's run by Alejandro del Torre, I think is his name. And he's been kind of beating the drum as one of the miners. He's from, I believe he is working with Poolin, one of the biggest mining pools, and has been kind of making it very clear that he's like, no, well, like the miners are going to support this when it comes out. And he's like reached out to a lot of pools and got them to publicly state that they will support it. So I'm pretty confident it's going to happen once speedy trial goes out. But I guess the main thing, if you're a layperson wondering what's going on, there isn't contention over whether or not we should get Taproot on Bitcoin. Basically, everybody wants it. The contention is what mechanism should we use in order to get it on there.
Why do the miners care one way or another what you guys decide to do to implement? Is it just because is it like a money issue, like a capital investment issue? Is it what is the problem that is making them second guess? Because my general feeling, based on the sentiment I see on social media, Reddit, these other places that you can kind of find out where Taproot is in the race, is the same as what you just described. It seems to be pretty widely accepted that it's going to happen. So why is it sort of a debate on how to implement? Why is that the issue?
I don't think the miners are making any trouble over this. Most of them are saying, yeah, we want this. This is going to be good for Bitcoin. It's just people are worried about what happened last time. And last time it was really chaotic. It was a scary time. Like, you know, we had no idea what was going to happen. Like, there were all these risks of chain splits. We did end up splitting like Bitcoin Cash, forked off and did its thing, which, you know, was a very good thing in hindsight, like, because like then they could experiment with their own ideas instead of trying to get us to do them. And, but yeah, I mean, it was a pretty reckless time. And like, things could have gone a lot worse than they did. And I think came close to going a lot worse than they did. And so I think it's everyone being really extra paranoid, which is probably a good thing in general, but it might have gone too far to the point where, you know, you kind of getting to the point where it's bike shedding. But like, to be honest, like the miners aren't making a fuss about it this time. By the way, I should clarify, like we're really oversimplifying talking about the miners as though there's this, you know, single, you know, monolith. You know, there was a, you know, a solid 30-40% of hash power back in 2017 was supporting SegWit from early days. But like right now it's mainly an internal, debate, among a lot of the different, you know, core developers and members of the kind of the Bitcoin community about how to activate it. But I mean, everyone wants it. Like, I mean, I think it's going to be kind of a nothing burger in the end. Like, I don't know if I'm going to get my head chopped off for that, but I'm pretty sure what's going to happen is that the speedy trial mechanism is going to come out. The miners are going to signal pretty quickly and we'll get Taproot later this year. I actually do have a bet going with someone that's more or less going to happen.
Now, one thing I'm dreading is the four.
Wait, we got to find out how much the bet's for. We got to find out how much is the bet for.
Oh, it's yeah. I made the bet with he's an Ethereum guy. I follow Jacob Elsef. I forget his name. But I bet him a 0.01 Bitcoin. I think it was
not insignificant.
Well, who knows? I mean, that could be worth, you know, $2 or $1 million by the end of the year. It's the way things go. So, I think it's 0.01 Bitcoin that it'll get activated by the end of the year. Actually, wait, no, it was 0.001 Bitcoin. So it was around 50 or $100, something like that. Yeah. So
now, and you mentioned the dreaded four letter F word fork, and I just want to stay on that a little bit. So I was listening to Guy Swan's recent podcast, and he was talking about that. There's, you know, potential from this whole Taproot implementation. There may be a fork in Bitcoin. I'm just wondering, where do you see that this will play out? What are the chances? I just try to ease my concerns if at all possible.
Sure. Okay. Well, there are a couple different types of forks, right? Like a soft fork is just an update to the network where everyone stays on the same thing. And that's one thing. Then there's a fork, like what happened with Bitcoin Cash, where a bunch of people decided they wanted to split off, create their own currency, right? And then there are accidental forks where people end up running incompatible clients, and then there are different chains. There's a bunch of chaos, even though everyone wants to be on the same currency. And that last scenario is what people are worried about, but I would say the chances of that are very, very low. What's happening right now is that there is another client that has been released, which is basically a forked version. Forked, again, we have another definition of this term, which is like the GitHub version where you copy the code and make some changes to it, right? So you have this forked version of Bitcoin Core. I forget what they're calling it. It's like Bitcoin Core-based Taproot or something like that. This is being championed by Lukesh Jr. and Bitcoin Mechanic, who happens to be a friend of mine in real life, but the two of them are, they don't think we should be like giving the miners any, this is my best understanding of their position, and I'm sure that they wouldn't be terribly happy, but I'm not probably doing it justice, but like they don't think we should like even give a chance to the miners to like think that they have any say over this. They shouldn't get a chance to cancel it. So right from the beginning, we can have something with like speedy trial, but then if it doesn't, it activates by a certain flag day. And then there was a debate about whether or not this like deadline by which like we have to have SegWit activated, or Taproot activated. There was debate about whether it should use block height or actual real world time. There are different ways to do it. And, you know, like, which again, like as long as we agree on one, in my opinion, again, I'm not a core dev, both of them are good enough for me as far as I'm concerned. But because this kind of alternate client, they have compatible code for the speedy trial portion, but then let's say speedy trial doesn't work, miners don't activate. And if like a small portion of the economy is running this alternate client, and like tries to activate SegWit before the rest of, or tries to activate Taproot before the rest of the network, they might end up on some smaller chain. By accident. Again, I think the chances of that are fairly low, partly because A, I'm quite confident that the miners will activate before then. And B, if you get to a situation where like either they're going to be so small and insignificant, they're going to realize that no one's running it and they're going to give up and we'll convene on another like mechanism. The other thing is if they end up getting enough support, then it reaches this tipping point where you kind of have to support it just to make sure everyone's on the same chain. This is a little bit like with what happened with UASF BIP 148 back in 2017. But again, I assign a very low probability to this kind of stuff. And it's also the sort of thing that it's not a danger of this happening tomorrow, next week, or next month. It'd be quite a long ways down the road. So there's time to reach consensus. But yeah, it's possible. I'm not ringing any alarm bells yet. But yeah, I'm also like, by the way, I wasn't expecting to talk about this today. Usually when I chat about with this with other people, I am trying to learn from them. So it's I really hope I haven't messed up in a big way.
I'm sure
we're going to hear about this.
You've been good.
If I say anything wrong, but I'm not too worried. Like I said, I bet about a sum that is going to work out by the end of the year.
I kind of want to get your thoughts since you're working in quote unquote the Bitcoin financial industry. We talk a lot on our show about the payment rails showing up from major credit providers, the banks' sort of reluctancy, and now maybe in some cases those same institutions catering to Bitcoin through investment vehicles and offering different crypto investment opportunities to their clients. What are you guys seeing at Ledin that sort of gives you pause about where we are in the quote unquote super cycle, if that's something you've considered? Is this really the escape velocity having epoch, you think, based on all these things that are happening in finance? Don't fall out of your chair there. You're leaning pretty far back, Mario. I don't want you to hit your head.
No, man, super cycle is not, I don't know, man. Price prediction is not my wheelhouse. I'm pretty sure Bitcoin's going to be worth a lot more 10 years from now. So I'm going to hang on to it. It's going to do all sorts of stuff in between. So super cycle is like, I don't know. I don't know. People often talk about these tipping points, these breaking points. I think, you know, the whole Bitcoin adoption thing is going to be, it's going to be very gradual and like, you know, it might accelerate or decelerate at different points. But yeah, like, you know, we're gradually more mainstream acceptance is coming on. Like, I mean, look at all these companies holding on their balance sheet. Like, you know, how cool is that? I would love to go back to like, you know, me back in 2016 and be like, hey, guess what, Mario? Tesla bought Bitcoin in 2021. Like that would have been such a cool thing to hear. I don't know if that's like, I don't put a lot of confidence in the whole like halvenings, like really breaking things up and like causing you know, these tipping points. I think TA is like kind of, it's a bit of tea leaves. You know, it's not really my wheelhouse, but yeah, I mean, it's undeniable that Bitcoin is becoming more and more ingrained and entrenched and like you know, accepted as part of mainstream finance. There's no question about it. I mean, yeah, we are an example of that. Like you can now get loans with Bitcoin as collateral. Like, we've come a long way, people. This is great.
Yeah, no doubt. And switching gears, I'm not sure if you're going to want to talk about this topic, but non-BTC related cryptocurrencies, are you supportive of any of them? Any of them, like they caught your eye? I'm just curious to see your thoughts on them.
I own Bitcoin and Bitcoin only, and I recommend others do the same. I like, got you, fam. Yeah, I mean, the guy's clapping, but he's talking about all the non-Bitcoin stuff he owns as well on the show. So I don't know
I don't own anything else besides Bitcoin. That was somebody else.
Yeah, you own like Coinbase shares, no. And you own like
equities. Like stocks. I got equities.
Like, so. Nah, it's got to be all Bitcoin, man. All Bitcoin. You need to have a negative dollar balance and everything else. I'm just kidding, guys. No. This is like not financial advice, guys. I totally kidding. I don't actually recommend people do that. I'm just ripping you. I'm not interested in the other cryptocurrencies. I think like some of them, like Monero, are interesting projects. I'm having a hard time thinking of legitimate ones other than Monero. Like, I mean, I don't know, like Mimblewimble was an interesting concept, but like, you know, Grin and I forgot what the other one is that's trying to implement it. I've had some sketchy things on how they've been launched, but I am very maximalist in that way. I'm not a big fan of the kind of aggressive toxic maxi culture, but I am very much aligned with them in terms of I mean, like, network effect is huge. Like, people aren't going to want to deal with, you know, friction between different currencies, and the incentives are so bad. Like, you know, once you're launching your own token, just like the fact that you can like print money and then just like run off with it having not built anything, we've seen that happen again and again and again. It's just like I try not to spend too much time talking about them. Like, I mean, if you have any like particular questions about how they compare and stuff, like, you know, I keep an eye on like what's going on like occasionally when I think it's relevant to Bitcoin, basically. But I hold, like, in terms of cryptocurrencies, I hold Bitcoin only, and I recommend others do the same.
I was wondering, now just wrapping things up, do you have any final thoughts or predictions what we were going to be expecting moving forward in a world of BTC?
What this is a broad question. I don't know. What timeline are you looking at? You want to narrow that down for me, or
Let's talk like two. Like, I think in 2 years, and this is just me thinking off the top of my head. Like, in 2 years, I don't think anymore that it's unreasonable to assume that maybe not like a major European or North American economy, but certainly maybe like a, you know, an Estonia, for example, which is already very friendly to digital and has a lot of digital native government services, digitally native government services, adds Bitcoin to their balance sheet or starts doing Bitcoin related stuff. I think it's possible some states in the next 2 years, specifically after the last, you know, month or 2 months, Miami with Mayor Francis Suarez over there, Wyoming with Cynthia Loomis and all these different places that have sort of Bitcoin friendly legislators and municipal politicians. I think there's a chance that the next 2 years is really bright for Bitcoin. But I'm curious what you think, because you guys are really in the space, right? You guys have your ears to the pavement as far as regulatory and things of that nature that would sort of give you a bit of a compass as to where we're going. So take it away.
Yeah, but honestly, I don't know what I could say other than what I was saying before. Like, I think, you know, it's going to be a long, steady road. Like, you know, the super cycles are like, I don't know, like, I'm hesitant to jump on stuff like that because, like, you know, yeah, we're never going to have like a massive price crash again. I don't think it's a safe thing to assume. So I don't want to, I don't want to be spreading that. But yeah, like, I mean, I don't know. For a lot of these questions, I don't think it's a matter of if, I think it's a matter of when. You know, every year that passes, you know, it more validates Bitcoin's security model. You know, I guess like I tend to think in terms of like, you know, I know like 2 decades from now, it's going to be really interesting seeing how, you know, we switch from the subsidy-based security model where miners are paid primarily from newly minted Bitcoins to fees-based security model. That's going to be really interesting. That's like when I think Bitcoin moves from becoming an experiment. It's got to get past that kind of hurdle. But, you know, again, that's going to happen slowly over the course of like next 10 to 20 years. I'm not really an expert on the regulatory end of things. Like maybe you can get, you know, Maurizio or Adam on here sometime. I think they're a lot more versed in this side of things because like they come from the, you know, they have the financial experience, whereas I'm coming from the sort of techie end of things. So it's hard for me to say on that. But yeah, I mean, I can't imagine myself working in any other industry. I've, you know, been betting a lot of my savings in my career on this, and nothing in the last, you know, year or two has you know, done anything to shake that in a big way. I will say as well, there's a lot of people getting involved in the space right now in the midst of a big bull run. Have a long time horizon. Like don't be buying this stuff if you expect to like make a return in 2 months. That's bad news. Like, you know, get in, like make, like be patient, you know, like look at what happened from like, you know, late 2017, early 2018, all the way down to, you know, the next year and a half. Like be prepared for that kind of thing to happen again. It might not. Great. If the super cycle happens, I'm not going to complain, but, yeah, I, you know, be in it for the long haul, yeah, be patient. There you go. That's not a prediction. It's unsolicited advice, but, that's what you get. Enjoy it.
You're talking to a couple of hodlers here. So we're in it for the long haul. We're not going to get rid of any of our sats, no matter
that was
what.
That was more for the audience than you guys.
Yeah, but yeah. No, but you're talking to us directly. And I can tell you right now, sure. we're not going to be moving our sats no matter what.
Mario, before we let you go, I don't think we talked at all about the podcast that you're on. I would like to hear, I want to hear 2 things. One, I want to hear who these other guys are on your show, because I had not been a huge Unhashed guy. It was on my subscription list for a time. It didn't make the cut years ago when I was a newbie. And now that we've started speaking, it's back on my list.
Yeah, it's so like there are 4 hosts. There's myself, Ruben Thompson, and Colin and Brian Alds. So we're an international podcast. We got me here in Canada. The Alds brothers are American, and Ruben is Dutch. And we all kind of know each other because Colin, Ruben, and I all lived in South Korea at the same time. So we met through Ruben and his meetup, and then Brian, we met through Colin. So you guys know a bit about me. Ruben is basically an independent researcher. He taught himself, you know, like cryptography basically from scratch, and has contributed a lot of research to the space. He's invented a couple novel layer 2 solutions like state chains and space chains and all these different things. So he's like, he's super knowledgeable. He's taught like most of what I know about Bitcoin. And then the Alds brothers run Privacy Pros, and what they do is they sell their kind of most well known product is the Bilfoddle. Or Bilfoddle, I forget how they pronounce it, which is like, it's similar to Crypto Steel. It's one of these, they sell like metal devices for you to keep your seeds stored, and different kind of security, you know, paraphernalia, that kind of thing. And yeah, we've all been friends for quite a few years, and like we're kind of used to, you know, yelling at each other on our Telegram groups about what's going on. And we kind of figured about, like, I guess the podcast has been running about 2.5 years now. I think it was late 2018 when we first started doing it. So we're up to 132 episodes. But yeah, it's like, it's explicit. Don't listen when you're around your kids. Some of our listeners have done that. Talking about you, Mike, in space. But it's kind of a combination of like, sometimes we like go really into detail and like, technical concepts and try and break them down for people. A lot of times it's just us, you know, shooting the shit about the news. And it's a lot of kind of, locker room talk and kind of raunchy humor if you're into that sort of thing. So I'm thrilled that as many people listen to it as they do, because like, again, it was just meant to be something for fun, but like, I don't know, people seem to like hearing us. So yeah, give us a listen. I think you'll find the most value in it if you're already pretty tuned into what's going on in the Bitcoin space. And don't take yourself too seriously. Give us a look. Yeah. unhashpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter. Same thing. Yeah.
There was some good content, Len. I don't know if you listened to their podcast, but there was a sort of a 3 or 4 minute stretch in the most recent episode where they transferred subject matter from the definition of fluffing, which one of the hosts pretended not to know the definition of, which is, that's bullshit. He definitely fucking knows what it means. And technical issues on Bitcoin. So that's the kind of content you get. It's good. Very diverse.
On brand for us. Yeah. our last, just, you know, I'm not going to say it in the show, but just look at the title of our most recent episode and that'll do it for you. Yeah.
This Mario, has been great.
Yeah. It's been awesome having you. Give us a handoff to your Twitter, to Ledin. Where can people find you and what you guys are doing? How can we pass our guys over to you guys if they want to find out more?
Yeah, absolutely. So we already plugged the podcast. That's unhashedpodcast.com or unhashedpodcast just on Twitter. My Twitter handle is Mario_Gibney. Check out Ledin, LEDN.io. It's like the word lend, but like hodled, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know. It's easier to see what's written. You'll get it. Yeah. Check out Lend, LEDN.io.
We will put it in the notes below.
Yeah. We'll definitely put it in. Mario, thank you for your time tonight, brother. And take care of yourself.
Yeah, thanks for having me on. This was fun.